Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. I'm Ray. This was released on Monday, the 27th of April, 2020. This is the second part of our culture conversation, which was recorded on the 19th of April, 2020. It follows on from the part one, so if you haven't listened to part one, we encourage you to go back and listen to part one first. This is part two with Sophie and Gary. Hope you enjoy. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate, rub the lamp, lad. Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, coming to you via Zoom. And today in the hub, we've got Sophie and Gary.
Hiya.
Hello.
To get back to, like, with leadership and, you know, so we talked earlier about the fact that the average tenure of a FTSE 100 chief executive is 5.5 years. If the people at the top need to be very much vision-based and looking forward, if you base the way they operate and you measure them, their KPIs are based on bottom line, quarterly forecasts, stock price, you know, in the short term, etc., etc., you're not really encouraging people to think of the longer term. Now, I, as I said earlier, I think this is largely because investors, so the shareholders in organizations are much more short term now, and they're looking to get in, get as much out of the organization as they can, and then move on. We're all looking for the quick buck. And what that drives is very short-term, myopic vision from leadership teams, because it's all about survival from one quarter to the next. It's not about where the, you know, if I'm only going to be with the organization for 5.5 years, how can I operate to make sure that that organization is fit for the future in 15, 20, 30 years time? Or am I just interested in squeezing the most out of it and maximizing my 5.5 year tenure so that when I walk away from it, I can say, I met your obligations, because your obligations were to drive share price, market share, whatever it might be, profitability. And you weren't telling me that I needed to make the organization sustainable and resilient for the next 20 years. And also, just a supplementary question for you both. If, and again, Simon Sinek talks about this a lot. If your short-term vision is protectionism, so I need to protect the bottom line, I need to protect the profitability, the growth, et cetera, in the short term, that stifles it. Innovation. So, you know, there's a reason why the music industry didn't invent iTunes, because the music industry was concentrating on selling albums to, you know, the album stores and stuff like that. Whereas iTunes was derived with the actual listener in mind, and as was the iPod, 1,000 songs in your pocket, as we've talked about before. You know, and there are other examples of that where, you know, industries have been completely changed. I mean, this Nokia were the preeminent mobile phone handset provider. You know, Apple came along and invented the iPhone. And because Nokia were more interested in protecting the status quo rather than actually having the ability and the culture that made them lift their heads up and look forward and see where the world was going, they got left behind. They fell dramatically behind the curve. Now, what's interesting about both of those examples is that if you asked anybody, you know, who should invent something that revolutionizes the music industry, it should be the music industry, not a computer company. Who should revolutionize the telecommunications industry? It should be telecommunications companies, not a computer company. But the difference is, Apple have a culture where they drive innovation. And everything they do in their organization is about maximizing the energy and the creative problem solving and the innovation and this constant drive to challenge the status quo all the time. So they're never looking at protectionism. They're always looking at where can we push the boundaries? What other markets can we move into and give it a proper good shaking up? So to actually ask the question that I want to ask after that long diatribe, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy for our organizations, this short-term myopic view of quarterly bottom line, annual bottom line share price? Is that making leaders look down and in instead of looking up and out?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought on that is, I mean, all companies should be, looking at themselves. And obviously, things like performance management, so on, and having things that you can measure, that's important. But I do think it's also about, there does need to be, kind of one eye on the kind of the now, one sort of eye looking a bit further ahead, and then one eye looking, you've got three eyes, looking, much further ahead, because that's where, you could see the opportunities. So I think where companies have, fallen down, that's because they were too slow to adapt or adjust to what was happening in the world around them. We can mention numerous examples of, companies that have gone bust because of that. But also there are, obviously now certain companies, from, Microsoft to Zoom and others, for a time like now is where they have massive opportunity. So for them, it's about how they can take advantage of that in a proper way. But also with the increasing scale, how they can also make sure that works as well. So for example, with Zoom, there've been problems with, people just being able to kind of jump onto other people's calls and things like that. So they've, had to sort of look at the, privacy and the protection and security side of things. But it's, absolutely. It does need to be, there can't just be a single focus on short term, because otherwise you're missing what's happening around you.
Okay, so I have a follow-up question then. So what you've got is, in a lot of large organizations, you have an interesting dynamic at the top. So you'll generally have a chief executive, and then under that chief executive, you'll have somebody like a COO, a chief operating officer, and probably a CFO, a chief financial officer. Now, they might not have those specific titles, but you'll generally have somebody who's responsible for finance and somebody who's responsible for operations. And they're very much your practical implementation kind of people, because the very nature of their role is they need to be looking down and in at the organization. But the chief executive, is that the person that needs to be looking up and out of the organization? Is that the person that needs to have the eye on the future, on the vision, on the culture, making sure that everything the organization does fits in with that? And so therefore, should that sort of triangle at the top be more of a three-way collaboration rather than a hierarchical situation? Because in most successful organizations, you had the visionary and you had the doer. Look at Apple, Steve Jobs was the visionary and Steve Wozniak was the doer. He was the guy that actually made stuff happen. And so often these successful relationships are those that are symbiotic, and it's not about hierarchy, status, or anything else. It's actually a good partnership of appropriate skills. The fact that 20% of our FTSE 100 chief execs come from a finance background. Now, I'm not saying for a second that finance people and accountants can't be visionary, but if you've spent your whole life looking down and in an organization, the question has to be, are you the best person to lead the vision? Or are you the best person to sit alongside the person who's leading the vision and you work in a symbiotic way? And I sometimes think when you get to that level of an organization, people at COO and CFO are looking for their next move is into CEO. And so you know, that's where their sort of focus is, rather than them considering themselves to be like a trinity and all working using their individual skills and aptitudes for the best of the organization. Because an incredibly strong leader who is a visionary and is looking out up and out needs to have to know that they've got those people alongside them who are watching their back, so to speak. So they're the ones who are looking down and in to the organization. What's your thoughts on that?
I think this goes back to a conversation we had a few weeks ago on the podcast around the role of a leader, the role of a manager, and how we are quite often asked to play two completely different roles, one of which may go against our natural tendencies. So we're expected to be, as a leader, somebody who is visionary, whether you are the chief executive or you are a head of service or you're leading a certain division. You're expected to be that person who is the visionary, the ideas person, is generating the way forward and is getting people on board to follow in that direction. And then equally, you've got to be the operational person, the person that's also got to manage the people, manage the finances, etc., etc. And I think the same is true of being a chief executive, of being that CEO at the top. We're asking a lot of that person to be able to play all those parts. So for me, the best cultures where I have seen it work, and has even worked fantastically in organisations when I was employed before I started consulting, is the organisations that are purely based on trust. Trust is one of their fundamental facets of their culture. And therefore, the chief executive doesn't have to play all of those roles. The chief executive can trust the right people to make the right decisions at the right time on their behalf. And equally, the chief executive isn't the only visionary in the organisation. Everybody's encouraged to be that. Everyone's encouraged to, and is trusted to, collaborate with each other, connect with each other, be creative with each other, to come up with the new idea. Because who knows, going back to your Nokia comment, that there wasn't a member of staff on that factory floor who was putting widgets inside a phone case who didn't think, oh my gosh, why don't we do this with this product? And all of that lost knowledge that doesn't get shared because of hierarchy, because of lack of collaboration, the organisations and the chief executives that succeed and organisations that succeed are the ones that allow the whole organisation to play their part in that and not just the chief exec.
Yeah, because everything has its cycle. You know, things come, things go. Trends, fashions, fads, they come and go. And so if you spend all your time protecting your current position and not constantly seeking to innovate, you're going to get left behind. At some point, you're going to miss the curve and you're going to get it wrong. And so I, for me, like, culture needs to work towards allowing people to innovate and allowing people to creatively think and creatively problem solve. And so your culture needs to be one such that it embraces the whole of the individual. It doesn't just say, right, from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the evening, we only want you from your neck up, because we only want you for your technical ability. And we want you to leave your emotions and your heart and your feelings and everything outside in the car park, because we're not dealing with all that sort of stuff. You're at work now. You've got to be a certain way. Versus an organization that says, the reason we need you is because you are a human being. And with a human being comes all of the creativity and the problem solving and the innovation and everything else. And we accept that with that comes a lot of other stuff as well. But we're not going to try and distill you and separate that out, because if we could do that, we'd all be robots. We're going to embrace you as a whole person. And we're going to work with you as a human being. And so we're going to set the environment and the culture so that you can thrive within that, if you know, that's what you choose to do. And I think those organizations are where you know if you've walked into one of those organizations, because the energy, the atmosphere and everything else is entirely different.
But you also know whether you've bought one of their products.
Yes.
So, yeah, so for example, my business bank account is not with a high street bank account. It's probably the bank account that most people wouldn't have heard of, unless you travel on the tube and you've seen the odd occasional advert they've got placed there now. But the difference between my experience of using my personal bank account, which is a high street brand, which everybody would know, versus my business bank account, which not many people would know, my experience and the culture that I have, that I see from those two different brands, is immensely different. And one I can tell is very radical, forward thinking, and will probably be a household name within a couple of years, because they are so forward thinking and down to earth and treat everyone like humans, versus the other bank which I'm with, which is I'm just the number and I generate income for them. And therefore they have to, you know, keep serving me. Oh, here's a fantastic credit card offer, or here's a new mortgage rate, et cetera, which doesn't serve me, isn't in my interest actually. And the cultural differences that I see between those two companies as a consumer is immense, as I'm sure we probably all could with decisions over what piece of tech to buy or what holidays to go on. We are seeing culture come through, not just from an employee perspective, but from a consumer perspective as well.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting on that, because sometimes I would consider myself to be an early adopter. And in some cases, I am like the herd. So, for example, with regards to fashion, I think anybody who knows me would never say that I'm an innovator. Or an early adopter. I am part of the large majority of people who will probably make fashion decisions based on price points, because actually I'm not that passionate about fashion. Whereas there are other things that I'm particularly passionate about because it speaks to me and about me. And so in those cases, I'm very much more inclined to coalesce or move towards an organization that has a strong message to me. So it is horses for courses, and it's, you know, it's not one size fits all, and you really got to know as an organization, you know, if you say, for example, Harley Davidson. So there are some people who, no matter what, will want a Harley Davidson and only a Harley Davidson. And they will wait 6 months to get it, and they'll pay a significant premium to buy a Harley Davidson. There are other people out there who are generic motorcycle enthusiasts who'll look at their purchasing decision based on, you know, spec and price points, et cetera, et cetera. They're sort of the early and late majority, if you look at the law of diffusion of innovation. And I guess for organizations, it's about finding your tribe and embracing that tribe into your values, and then almost using the momentum that tribe creates for you, your cult following, if you like, to influence the purchase decisions of the early and late majority. Because people like me, in terms of fashion, I will never go out and buy something new, a new radical trend. I'll generally just keep buying the same stuff that I always buy, based on price or whatever. But if I see something that a lot of people are sort of gravitating towards, that will make me sit up and look at that, and may influence my purchasing decision. And I think organizations don't always consciously link what they're saying internally, what they're saying externally, and looking to create that loyalty of purchase. If you have to rely on manipulation to drive a purchase decision, and let me tell you, manipulation works, because there's all sorts of different manipulations out there, and they obviously do work, but it's a constant, you know, you're constantly running to keep up with, you know, oh, we're going to, you know, another sale, or a new version of our product that's got a slightly better bells and whistles or whatever. You're constantly competing with everybody else. If you're an organization who is very, very values based, actually the only people you're competing with are yourselves, and you're communicating that to the outside world, and you're embracing those early adopters and supporting them to influence the early and late majority. And that's what drives long-term sales rather than just a short-term turnaround. And that's, you know, that's evidenced in all sorts of organizations that bring out new things. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Samsung Razr when it came out, mobile phone. Everybody had one. It was a sexy, sleek looking thing. Everybody wanted a Razr. Mm-hmm. And it did very well for 3 or 4 years. And then somebody came along with something better or sexier or, you know, faster, more features, whatever. And, you know, Samsung just became another telecommunications company. So, you know, if you're constantly trying to drive, right, what's the next big offering we're going to have? You know, you end up in the situation like Colgate, where they've got like over 20 different brands of toothpaste because they're constantly trying to add things to it to drive a purchasing decision. If you drive an emotional engagement decision, it's much easier to influence the purchasing decision that comes along after it. And just, I want to ask about, like, with Gary, with marketing and stuff, that I get your mission and your message to your clients and to the wider world about things needing to be story-based and things needing to be more about your why and not so much about just what you do. But how can we encourage organizations to start thinking more about that? Because for a lot of organizations, they're very much in the here and now. It is a bit of a hamster wheel. You're constantly looking to, you know, drive trade and drive business. How do we encourage people just to take a little step back and look at things in a wider context?
Yeah, there's many things there. I mean, first of all, I think all organizations and companies should be looking at a story, and they should be building that into the way they operate, because your vision and your values, your backstory, all of that is story. So we're not talking about, you know, Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. When I'm talking about story, it's how you present yourself, you know, on your website and in your communications, that's internally and externally. And using stories is one way to get those messages across. So if you actually wanted to have a company where you're, as Sophie said, and they say, oh, we want to have this cultural refresh and we want to kind of do it this way, stories are a really good way of getting that across, rather than saying to people, right, we're having a cultural refresh, you're going to do it this way, folks. Because, as I say, people don't like being told, but people are smart enough to understand a message within a story, okay? And they can take from it what they need to move forward. And because stories are often, or if they're good stories, they will be memorable. So people will be sharing that and saying, you know, remember that story about that. That really helps people to focus it, rather than looking on a wall and something says, you know, honesty and integrity. You know, let's have some stories about what does honesty or integrity mean. Ask people, and not just the leaders, it should be from all levels. You were talking earlier about sort of vision and so on. I think the vision and the looking for what's coming up, the opportunities, that should be across the organization. You should be encouraging people, and you could even say one of our values is, I don't know, we look ahead. You know, we as a board and leaders don't always see everything. We need you to be our eyes and ears as well. So if you see something and you think, oh, that might be a really good idea, you know, let somebody know.
I think that's such an important point there, Gary. I mean, when I was paid employment before I started my own organisation, the last job that I was in, I was director of HR and workplace wellbeing. And I worked for a London social housing organisation, and one of the values, key facets of our culture and service delivery was that of co-creation. And that mainly was a word that we would use for co-creating with our residents that lived in our properties. So if there was a big fundamental decision that was going to be made about the business that would affect the way they live in their homes, it was our duty to co-create what that would look like with them. And part of my job was to then say, well, co-creation isn't just a buzzword for the consumer, for the resident. Co-creation is also a word for us to be using internally. And quite often, there's a mismatch between that bold statement or the values, the behaviours, et cetera, is about being of service to the consumer and not necessarily being of service to your internal customer, which is your staff. So my role was then, exactly as you've just described, Gary, was about that co-creation of everybody in the organisation deciding what certain bits should look like. There are bits that actually the organisation could allow staff to make decisions on, could ask for ideas, could embed that trust piece that people are going to make the right decisions at the right time because actually everyone's bought into our why. I think that's absolutely key that it works both ways. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, Gary, was Ray mentioned a little while back about the role of the CEO and the leader and the role they play, obviously given the churn that you've mentioned of 5 years. I know your background's in education, and I just wondered what that looks like from the education perspective in terms of leaders in that particular role.
Yes, again, I think that it's very similar, I think, where the head teacher should not be expected to be doing everything. But I do think you want someone who has that vision, and that normally that would be the head teacher, but they don't then have to do all the other bits. So you could have someone who looks after more of the technical financial side, and you've actually got the head teacher is almost like the head coach, and they can bring in their deputies as the specific coaches for specific things. But also it's about how you spread that culture. So I do think within that you also want input from the staff and also from the kids as well. How would you like your school to be? Because you're going to get so much from not just listening to the adults, but actually the biggest population of consumers in the school are the kids. So why would you remove them from a process where you could actually say, we want to serve you and educate you and look after you to the best of our abilities. How could we do that better? Or how do you see the school now? What would you like to see different? Wouldn't that be something that would reveal so much? You might not like all the answers and responses you get, but wouldn't that be refreshing? Out of education, there was an estate agent in the southeast, and that they were a family business, and they saw themselves as a family business. They kind of believed they were promoting themselves as a family run business, but when they worked with an external marketing company, when they did the research came back saying people think you're corporate, they think your website's corporate, they think you're just one of these kind of big companies, just like any of the big companies. They don't they're not getting this family business. We'll give you that care and attention to detail that we've been given, and they were flabbergasted, and it took they had to sort of change their marketing to get that message across, saying, no, hey, we really are a family run business, and here's why, here's the story of it. And so I think that's, sometimes you do have to sort of get that feedback to, because you don't always see it yourself. So I think being strong enough to be able to say, yeah, we'd really like some feedback. And obviously having somebody who's sort of external who can come in, who's got no axe to grind, can just say, well, look, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm hearing, this is what I'm observing. That could be really, really powerful to help feed into that, how are we doing question.
And I do some of that with my clients, actually, Gary. I do cultural audits with them to look at what they think is the culture, that what the leaders think is the culture of the organisation. And then I test that against what the staff say is the culture of the organisation. And it's not just necessarily through a survey, I'm looking at, look at your turnover, look at your retention figures, look at how many people were internally promoted, look at your equal pay gap, look at all these things come into play where I can paint a picture for them to say, actually, this is not necessarily the truth for you and your organisations. And I think it's easier for organisations, particularly in a sales environment, for them to do that external analysis, look at the customer. Does the customer realise that we're a family-run business rather than a big corporate conglomerate? But don't quite often do the internal work to get that perspective. So I think that's a really interesting point to make around the data analysis you're gathering on your customers should equally be a similar exercise to understand the employee experience as well.
Yes, because I did some work, marketing work for a company, and it almost felt like I was doing a bit of social work as well, because what was happening was you had a leader of the company and saying, you know, that the team don't quite seem to get the vision, they don't seem to kind of get what, you know, so he just said, would you kind of, whilst you're here, kind of spend some time talking to them? So I just went round talking to different people and asking them what they did. And then I was just asking them sort of, so, you know, what does the company stand for? You know, what are the values of the company? And I must have interviewed, you know, half a dozen, eight people, and not one of them could tell me anything about the values of the company. Or they just said, well, we just come here and we do our job and then we go home, you know, we do a good job. Mm-mm. Isn't that enough? it's interesting, you know. It's like, I was saying to them, you know, it's not just a marketing job you've got here. You've got a, you know, you've kind of got a sort of coaching job to do here, you know, because if you want to take the company where you want to take it, you need to have these people on board more than they are, because they haven't bought into anything.
Absolutely.
Just on that, because one of the things I hear quite a lot from people is, you know, it's very hard to measure culture and stuff like this. One of the ways that I discovered that you can look at things, which is a pretty good indicator, it's not a silver bullet by any means, is the FREDI accreditation. Now, FREDI stands for Fairness, Respect, Equality, Diversity, Inclusion and Engagement. And it's an external accreditation that you can get. But unlike a lot of the accreditations where you submit an amount of data and you get assessed on whether you meet certain criteria or not, FREDI is something that you have to demonstrate through everything that you do. So it involves taking surveys of people, anonymous surveys. It involves setting up working groups, steering committees, and actually creating a calendar of events whereby you are able to increase your awareness of all of these different facets of FREDI. Now, I did a recording last weekend with a friend of mine, Julia, and we talked specifically about FREDI because she coordinated it for a company that we both worked for in the past. And so I encourage people to access that cast when it comes out sometime later this week. But again, it's a good way of initially getting that sort of temperature gauge of where your organization is at. And what I particularly like about it is it's not something that you can fudge, because what you get is you get an external coordinator comes in that's appointed to you by FREDI, and they effectively work with your organization to measure and improve and engage with all these things. And it lays you bare. So if you're a business owner who has an impression of their organization that, oh, you know, we're very fair, we're, you know, very inclusive and we're very equal, et cetera, et cetera. There's no hiding it once you go through the FREDI process, because everything gets exposed. And so you, before you embark upon it, you have to genuinely want to believe that this is what you want to do. It's not, you're not going to do it and have your biases confirmed. If you've got biases, whether they're conscious or unconscious, they will be exposed. And you will find out the truth of your organization. And that's a very empowering thing for a progressive proactive, generative organization, because you can actually tangibly measure all of the things you do that manifest in whether you're fair, whether you're respectful, whether you're equal, you know, whether you're diverse. And it shows you the benefits of having all those things in your organization. When it comes to, we talked earlier about having the right people in the right roles. You know, the more diversity you can have, the more inclusion you can have with your people, the more engagement with your people that you can have. That's where all the real innovative nuggets come from within an organization, because somebody is empowered at whatever level in the organization to step forward, knock on the boss's door and go, hey, I have had this idea. What do you think? Without fear of being judged, without fear of being usurped, or without fear of being in some way disadvantaged by having the gall to approach a senior leader with an idea. And I think, you know, to have that in your culture, like, wow, because you're not likely to miss a great innovation or a great idea there, because everybody's encouraged to constantly be challenging the way you do everything for the greater good. And that's Freddie. I encourage you all to check it out. Just to come back to just very briefly the storytelling, Gary, with regards to culture and vision and mission and purpose and everything. One of the reasons I particularly resonate with your philosophy around storytelling is that one of the ways that we work with people to find their why is through story. One of the things we do is we ask people to pick between 6 and 10 significant stories from their life about either something that they did or an experience they had or somebody they interacted with. And you ask them to talk you through the story and what it meant for them and what the long-term takeaway from it was. The idea being that by examining their life through story, you actually start to pick out common themes within those stories about maybe the sort of person that they aspire to be or the sort of person that they see themselves as. And you just over a couple of sessions, you distill that down into a common thread, which actually almost writes their why statement for them. And it's all to do with story. And the facilitator is really there just to support the storyteller to pick out the common threads within their stories. And within everybody, we all have a why statement. It's just that most of us have never had the opportunity to uncover it. And it's uncovered, one of the most powerful ways to uncover it is through storytelling. And if people want to get in contact with Gary Spinks's storytelling, they can do so at garyspinks.com. Is that correct, Gary?
That is correct, yes.
And I'd encourage them to sign up to your mailing list. I have. It's very good. It keeps me entertained. And I'm loving it. Especially the fast show.
Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah, that's just a temporary thing during while all this stuff is going on. But yeah, I mean, story is great because we were talking earlier about the values, and stories are a great way of expressing values. So, for example, I was walking down the street the other day and I saw a £20 note lying on the pavement, and I picked it up and then I thought, should I take it or should I not? So that story could go either way. So you could demonstrate that as, yes, I'm an honest person, or you could say, you know, that shows that, oh, I saw somebody else do that and they picked it up and I thought, oh, should they really be doing that? Or you could make this story even more extreme and you could talk about, you just passed a cash point machine and suddenly all this money started pouring out and it's at night, so the bank's shut. So what do you do? So do you just leave it? Do you pick it up, take it home? Do you pick it up and then go the next morning into the bank and hand it all over? Do you hand it all over but keep a little bit for yourself? You can make so many different stories out of that, but it would tell something about your values.
Mm. And that's interesting to me because I've started to, as I've been going along my journey, I've started to look at some of my behaviors in terms of I did something And it was absolutely legitimate and fine and ethical and everything else. But you know what? I just didn't feel like it really represented the best of me or what I believe about myself. And that includes employment decisions. So I've taken jobs before because it was convenient in terms of maybe commuting, or it was a slightly better salary or whatever. But actually, I never felt at ease with it. And, you know, on some occasions, I actually felt like going home at the end of every day and scrubbing myself with a wire brush. And I didn't stay long with those organizations. And I think there is an awful lot about coherence and balance and understanding your own values and then seeking to work with organizations and consume products and engage with brands that represent your values, because you'll have there'll be no cognitive dissonance there. You'll be completely in balance with what you believe and what you're doing. And a lot of people, unfortunately, they know something's not quite right, but they can't put their finger on what it is. And I would encourage people, if you want to have a more fulfilling life, pick up an opportunity to examine that about yourself, because it's one of the greatest personal advancements you will ever make in your life. And we've all probably had experiences where, you know, maybe we bought a telly and we stood in the shop for an hour agonizing between that telly and that telly. And we bought a telly based on some random sort of decision making. And we've got home, and then the next door neighbor comes out and goes, "Oh yeah, I bought the other telly. It's fantastic. It's great. I love it." And you're sitting there thinking, did I make the right choice? Because you made the choice based on rational decisions, not on emotional decisions. If you make your choices initially based on emotional decisions, what feels right to you, and then use your rational brain to rationalize between, okay, so I'm going to go with that brand. I just need to decide whether it's that model or that model. It's much easier to feel at ease with your decisions than maybe to feel like you've been a little bit of a dirty boy because you've just gone with the cheapest or whatever it might be. And I do think that's important to people more than a lot of people realize, that emotional balance within themselves to go, yeah, I'm actually living my own values. And I guess when it comes to working in an organization or with an organization, you also need to feel like there's that shared value there, because it is difficult to work with an organization whose beliefs are entirely contrary to your own and you feel compromised. Now, you might be able to rationalize that by saying, well, the only way I can influence these organizations is by working with them, and that's absolutely valid. Or you may decide, no, I'm sorry, it's just a stretch too far. I can't live with that cognitive dissonance to allow me to work with them. And that's, you know, they're both equal and valid decisions to be made. There's no right and wrong there. It's about what feels right to you at that time.
So that's it, folks. Our starter for 10 on culture. By no means the be-all and end-all, for sure. And on that note, we're very, very interested to hear your feedback on your experiences of culture in organizations that you've led or you've worked in, that you currently work in, that you hope to work in the future. What sort of culture would attract you, and how would that manifest itself in terms of a job advert? We'd love to hear your thoughts and your experiences. So please get in touch at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. And the giving just gets better and better this week, folks. We're going to, later on in the week, we're going to have a conversation released where we talked a little bit about contracting. Now, this is particularly interesting to people who are involved in coaching, but actually we believe that there is a space for contracting just in day-to-day business communications and business arrangements. And so we encourage you to access that when it comes out later this week on the usual platforms. We'll also be releasing a conversation that I had with Julia regarding coaching, and that kind of leads in and works quite nicely with the whole contracting conversation. So please look out for those later this week, and they'll be advertised on our Facebook and on our website and LinkedIn and everywhere else that we're able to interact with the outside world. So enjoy the rest of your week. We hope you stay safe and good luck.
They didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission. Listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction.